Chapter 21. Debacle on the Dardanelles. The Russian Panslavists, in greater distress than the others, were the first ones to demand the intervention of Italy. Despite the weakness of Austria-Hungary, the Russian army had not been able to smash her. By 1915, only the creation of a new front on the northern extremity of Italy could offer the likelihood of providing the Tsarist regime some relief. If intervention by the Italians could be achieved, part of the Austrian forces on the eastern front would have to be transferred immediately to the new field of battle in the Tyrol. That would mean hundreds of thousands fewer combatants facing the Russians and Serbians. Wright had nothing to do with these plans. Italy was not threatened by anyone. On the contrary, the later Italy entered the European conflict, the fewer deaths the adventure would cost. But the Panslavists could not wait, as is shown by the astounding remarks that Grand Duke Nicholas had charged Ambassador Palaiologue with transmitting to Poincaré at the end of 1914, after only a few months of war. The Grand Duke's warning was as sharp as a saber thrust. "I must speak to you of serious matters. I am not talking to you now as Grand Duke Nicholas, but as a Russian general. I am obligated to tell you that the immediate cooperation of Italy and Romania is an imperative necessity." The former warmonger-in-chief of July 1914 had added, "I say again and I emphasize, of inestimable value." Yet the Russian government had nearly 500,000 more soldiers at its disposal than the Austrians and Germans combined. At one time, the Tsarist regime disposed of twice as many. At the end of January 1915, she mustered 1,843,030 soldiers against 1,071,000 German and Austrian troops combined. But already Russia's leaders felt the ground giving way. That the Austro-German pressure be reduced was imperative. Otherwise, though hardly into the war, Russia stood to lose it. The situation of the Western Allies was scarcely less perilous. Despite the costly victory of the Battle of the Marne, which had represented no more than the reconquest of a department, the French High Command had persisted in its wish to return to the offensive in the dead of winter. On December 16, 1914, it had tried to break the German front in Artois, and had been unable to drive a wedge in anywhere. From December 20 to January 30, 1915, it attacked again, this time in Champagne. A second defeat. The attack was resumed from February 16 to March 16, 1915. A third defeat. Miserable terrain, abominably wet. Impossible to make any headway. The artillery was inaccurate. On several occasions the French guns fired on the French infantry. No advance, and a terrible massacre on the German barbed wire entanglements, which were uncrossable. Yet the lesson of this triple carnage would have no effect. In May and in June of 1915, French, English, and even Canadian troops would again be sent off to the slaughter. The maximum ground gained would be a kilometer at one point, 4 kilometers at another. In September 1915, the British and French would give that back for the fifth time in less than 10 months. Then the command would double the stakes, mounting two offensives simultaneously, in Artois and in Champagne. Joffre's order of the day: allow the enemy neither rest nor respite until the achievement of victory. But as he confessed to the King of Belgium, it may succeed and it may not. It didn't. The British command counted on winning through a surprise weapon, poison gas. But the winds were unfavorable, and the gas rolled back upon their own troops. In Artois it was impossible even to cross the first river, the Soche. In Champagne the Germans cleverly slipped away, settling down 4 kilometers to the rear in a second line of positions. The French would bang their heads against a stone wall there for 11 days. Finally, they would have to end their useless attacks and dig in once again. At whatever cost, Joffre had said. They were learning the cost: 400,000 dead or taken prisoner and 1,000,000 wounded or evacuated due to illness. British losses were of similar proportion. The front had become a death trap. A different tack was needed, some pretext or other to bring about additional fronts on which new, foreign armies would bear the brunt instead of the French and British armies. The Tommies and Poilus had been bled white 5 times in succession in a matter of months and were at a point of an exhaustion which could prove fatal. The Russian and Anglo-French political interests thus coincided. The winning over of Italy was of great importance. An Italian front would provide a safety valve, and Italy represented a source of several million new soldiers, a magnet that would draw enemy forces to the Tyrol and to the Adriatic. Italy's support was all the more indispensable because Germany herself had been reinforced by Turkey. Turkey, as a matter of fact, had entered the war against the Tsarist expansionists on October 29, 1914. Just before Britain's declaration of war on August 4, 1914, Germany had been able to slip her 2 splendid cruisers, the Goeben and the Breslau, through the straits and past Constantinople as nimble and quick as 2 flying fish. A few days earlier they had still been in the middle of the Mediterranean. In the course of a sensational odyssey, they had been able to elude the Allied ships pursuing them, making sport of them thanks to their speed. Since then they had bottled up the Russian fleet, preventing the Russians from exporting wheat and receiving war material. On August 29, 1914 they had boldly bombarded Sevastopol, Odessa, and Novorossiysk. One important advantage for Germany, with Turkey in the war, considerable Russian forces would be drawn to the Caucasus and held there. Another outstanding consideration, Turkey was Muslim, the Sultan the spiritual leader of Islam. Turkey might thus stir up all the Islamic countries then under British control and foment rebellion in them. At that time Turkey extended almost to the Suez Canal, her armies would perhaps even be able to reach it and cut that vital artery of the British Empire. The Allies, conscious of the danger, had tried everything since the beginning of August 1914 to counteract German offers. The British and the French had gladly made the Turks extraordinary concessions in Thrace and in the Aegean Sea in order to win them over to their side, or at last to keep them neutral. But the Russians had gone to war on August 1, 1914 precisely and primarily in order to win Constantinople. Consequently, the Russian expansionists not only didn't dread a war on the part of the Allies against the Turks, they longed for it. Thus the Anglo-French-Turkish negotiations ran completely counter to their own intentions. Sazonov replied to the Anglo-French negotiators that in allowing talks he desired only to gain some time without making any declarations which would bind us to anything. Britain, anxious to make an alliance with Turkey, had gone so far as to offer to guarantee her the integrity of her territory, hence of her capital, Constantinople, the #1 objective of the Panslavs. At the same time, however, with a hypocrisy worthy of centuries of duplicity, the British establishment had informed the Russians in great secrecy that the guarantee was valid only for the duration of the war in progress, and that Russia would always be able, after the conclusion of the general peace, to resolve the question of the straits to her own satisfaction, Renouvin, La Crise Européenne, page 263. The Russians, knowing the British and sensing the trap, demanded a written pledge of unlimited duration, which put an end to these duplicitous negotiations. The parleying had lasted no longer than it would have taken an ox to cross the Bosphorus. It hadn't been viable, the Anglo-French aims and the Russian aims were completely antithetical. When it had come to the bidding, Germany had won. The Panslavists, their pretensions unscathed and the game of the perfidious British establishment countered, were no better off, for they were now faced with another front right in the middle of the Caucasus. This made it all the more imperative for them to mitigate the new danger by creating another Allied front in Italy or Romania. In autumn 1914 the Japanese were able to provide the Allies with a measure of compensation for their misadventures with the Turks. On August 23, 1914, the Japanese, on the other side of the globe, entered the war against Germany. The internal quarrels of the Europeans were no more to Japan and a news story from a faraway land. The only importance of the war in their eyes was the opportunity it afforded them of seizing Germany's indefensible territories in the middle of the Pacific, and in the Far East, in particular the outstanding naval base of Kaichau in the Shantung province of China. The Germans, their hands full in Europe, were at a loss to defend far eastern possessions 10,000 kilometers from Berlin, while their lives were at stake at Château Thierry on the Marne at the end of August 1914. On November 7, 1914, the handful of Germans defending Shantung was obliged to capitulate. At the same time, Japan seized the port of Tsingtao. The Allies, especially the French, naively imagined that the Japanese, their pockets thus effortlessly filled, would immediately come running to the west as intrepid knights on the side of right. Unbelievably ingenuous, the French and British leaders asked the Japanese to form an expeditionary corps of 3 or 4 army corps for that purpose. That would have brought hundreds of thousands of Japanese soldiers to the European fronts. "We must not overlook any means," French Minister Delcasse declared. In fact, the Japanese would not be seen in Paris until 40 years later, after two world wars. Their weapons would then be autos, cameras, and video cassettes. A note from the Japanese government politely informed the Allies that apart from one or another symbolic mission, its troops were assigned to their home territory and did not intend to take part in foreign conflicts of whose causes they knew nothing. The French politicians simply couldn't understand. The Japanese Prime Minister had to explain it to them a second time. "What is the need of sending Japanese troops to Europe if we have no direct interest there?" It was Churchill, imaginative to the point of extravagance, who furnished the first new field of battle. He had already dreamt of a landing in Schleswig, then in the Adriatic near Pola. Now he fixed his gaze upon Europe's other extremity, the Dardanelles. It was a way of chastising the Turks for not responding to British promises and for having preferred those blockhead Germans. The Germans had been on the best of terms with the Sublime Porte for some years. In Anatolia, before the war, they were constructing a railway line intended to link Germany and Baghdad. Thanks to the new railroad, Turkey was opening up her territory to European trade. In exchange, German industrialists had obtained mining and oil concessions on both sides of this Asian railway line. There remained only 900 kilometers of rail to throw across the desert, and Berlin would have a balcony on the Persian Gulf. For the British bankers of the city, the intrusion of the Germans into the Near East was poaching. The Gulf belonged to them. Hurling a British army at the Turks would drive off competitors and assure their monopoly on petroleum, which in 1914 was as British as whiskey was Scotch. Finally, forcing passage of the straits would enable them to join up with the Russians. It is hard to imagine an operation offering more hope, Balfour prophesied. Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, was so sure of entering Constantinople, like the Ottomans in 1453, that he proposed naming his expeditionary force the Constantinople Expeditionary Force. On January 28, 1915, the British government ratified his plan. There was grumbling in the ranks, however. Lord Fisher, his assistant, was convinced that without the complete support of the Greeks, who were clinging to their neutrality, the operation would be a monumental failure. But to rope the Greeks into the campaign meant bringing them to Constantinople, which they were as anxious to conquer as were the Russian Pan-Slavists. That ran the risk of seeing an archon, as in the time of the Byzantine Empire, set himself up there instead of the Tsar. George V had promised the city to his St. Petersburg cousin, who was absolutely determined to be another Basiliscus. So it would be necessary to dispense with the Greeks temporarily. There was another complication. The Allied generals, whose forces had taken a terrible beating on the French front, refused to furnish any contingents. Churchill, who would have ousted the Eternal Father from his celestial throne if he had found him at all hesitant, wasn't disconcerted in the slightest by something so minor. He wouldn't even consult with Joffre, nor with the French, whom he knew to be hostile to his plan. He decided that he would open up the Sea of Marmora with his fleet alone. The Turkish forts at the neck of the straits. The artillery of Churchill's 15 cruisers and battleships would blow them to bits. The channel. His dredgers would clean it out like a swimming pool. The French fleet would take part, too, in this great nautical junket. Only the Russians, smelling Greeks everywhere, and at bottom distrustful of this British plan, refused to participate. Yet, the prize having been promised to them, they more than anyone else should have been interested in the project's success. Churchill was so enthusiastic that Lord Kitchener, though not convinced, finally agreed like everyone else, but with an odd reservation. One of the merits of the plan is that if it doesn't meet expectations, it will be possible to break off the attack. Churchill, a cigar in his fist like the lance of Patroclus, sounded the call to action on March 18, 1915. Under the command of Admiral Carden, the magnificent British fleet, augmented by French ships, fell into line at the entrance to the straits. The Turkish batteries, camouflaged on the nearest hills, were soon silenced. The Turks' German advisers had planned the defense very well, however. The shores were sown with traps and the water with mines. The big Allied warships hit them one after the other, and each one sent 1,000 or 2,000 sailors to the bottom. Breaking through was impossible. It was a Trafalgar in reverse. The bombardment continued for 5 days. A number of Turkish batteries were destroyed, but since no landing forces accompanied the expedition, it was without success. The German and Turkish losses were insignificant, 200 men in all, while strewn in every direction were the bodies of thousands of Allied sailors, floating like buoys in the shining seas. Without landing troops, it was useless to try again to pass through the channel. Each attempt meant sending cruisers and destroyers to the bottom, their admirable crews standing at attention at the moment of their death. Churchill had showed himself nothing but a braggart and a gravedigger of English and Scottish sailors. It was necessary to withdraw, albeit painfully and with difficulty. A third of the expedition's men and some of His Majesty's finest warships lay strewn about the bottom of the Dardanelles forever. This disaster inflicted on her fleet by a few Germans and Turks was intolerable to the pride of Britannia, ruler of the waves. It had to be answered. What had been lacking was support from ground forces. Therefore, despite all Churchill's promises that the fleet alone could clear the sea, an expeditionary corps was mounted, with the task of pinning down the Turks along the Hellespont. As always with Churchill, it was begun in an improvised fashion. There had been no careful preparation by the combined staffs. 30,000 men were to be landed in confusion, and it was they who would be pinned down, not the Turks, whom the German tacticians maneuvered in masterly fashion. The luckless French and English soldiers on the beaches died of thirst, shot, shell, and then typhus. They had to be reinforced. 5 new divisions were landed on the scorching sands at the foot of the enemy fortifications, where they in turn were cut to pieces by high-angle fire. In London, generals and admirals hurled abuse at each other. A cabinet crisis ensued. The Allied soldiers on the straits were at death's door, and again new divisions were sent in piecemeal. Thousands of Australians were thrown into the breach. Like the French in the Belgian Ardennes in August 1914, the Allies did not even have good maps of the region. There were no hospital ships, even though a whole army lay dying under the torrid sun without food or supplies. Troops were landed and landed again, only to be decimated each time. Nearly 500,000 men would follow one another to that hellish shore, 145,000 would be killed or wounded there. The survivors, heartsick to the point of nausea, could be thrown back into the sea by the Germans and Turks at any time. It was even decided in London to divert and recall the relief convoys, including the clothing sent to withstand the winter. 3 weeks later the cold and snow swept down on the unfortunates, 200 died of the cold, 5,000 had their feet frozen. It was one of the great tragedies of the war. After the Somme, Artois, and Champagne, in 1915 yet another dreadful disaster for the Allies. Churchill extricated himself by having himself sent on a staff mission to France, where he was tolerated for only 6 months. As for the expeditionary force, it was impossible to bring back from the Dardanelles the defeated troops, who, ravaged by typhus, were skeletal. One had to save face. Salvation was Salonika, a large Greek port, hence neutral. Allegedly, the British had entered the war on August 4, 1914, because of the violation of Belgian neutrality. Greece was as neutral in 1915 as Belgium had been the previous year. She was nonetheless to be violated in her turn. Such was the War of Right. In August 1915, despite the protest of the King of Greece, Constantine I, the Allies landed with their rifles, their cannon, and their dying on the neutral docks of Salonika.